Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. This time, I'm introducing you to Aaron French, and he is the living perfect example of, you know, you kind of think your life is going to go in one direction, and then suddenly, several years later, you're in a place that you did not expect to be. Now, Aaron began life as a scientist, as a biologist, and as you'll hear in this interview, the universe had other plans for him. For me, it's such a good reminder that the path that I think I'm on, or the one that I think that I'm supposed to be on, well, maybe it just isn't the right path for me. And being flexible in this life, going with the flow, looking at the signs, hearing the signs, all of that is so important. And as Aaron tells in this episode, he listened to the signs, and you know what? He had a choice, but he also didn't have a choice for what he's doing now. I could tell you what Aaron's doing and how he's moving in the world, but really, I think Aaron does a much better job of it. So now, without further ado, here's my interview with Aaron French.
During my awakening, one thing that started to happen was that words of truth would start to illuminate, is the word I use. You know, so as you know, being, you know, a doctor of divinity is this period of time in the medieval ages where the Christian books would be illuminated with gold and beautiful drawings. And they called them illumination they were bringing life to the scripture through these beautiful ornate drawings. And so I was awakening through this process a number of years ago, and I was driving by on the freeway, and there'd be this billboard with some words of Jesus. One of the Christian groups would have a billboard of, you know, listen to Jesus. And all of a sudden, some of his words just like glittered in gold and then like danced off the page.
If you had to go to a group and kind of introduce yourself, how would you do that?
Yeah, beautiful question. I mean, the most honest thing I could say, like, who am I as a human being, is sort of like, why did my soul choose to be here now in this time and space? And, you know, I'll preface this by saying, like, my whole life, every 10 years or 5 years, I've reinvented myself multiple times. I was a biologist. I was a corporate MBA. I was a chef. I was a photographer, different things. And so I've given different answers over the course of my life. And about 5 years ago, 6 years ago now, I had this epiphany where I realized I'm here on earth to be here right now, to do this work, to step into my power, to be one of the people, and there are many of us, to be one of the people right now who are here to shine the light on awakening and supporting others in that, and just be a voice for the energies coming through from beyond this realm. And so, you know, that's who I am now, is just a being who is here to, in every way possible, whatever that is for me, shine the light on what's beyond and to support people into awakening into their true selves.
Okay, great answer. I like asking this next question because, especially with you having so many different jobs or maybe passions, when you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so I had a very unusual childhood in that I didn't go to a normal school until like fourth grade. So, and I was raised, it's not that I didn't go to school, but the school was, I think we would now call it like unschooled. There was a collection of kids who, we went to a building and played around all day with each other and did whatever we did. But like when I went to normal school, I could barely read and write, and I didn't know any normal math, and I had to catch up with all of the things. But what I did learn was like how to look at and see auras and even cut them and repair them. And I learned like Braille and sign language, but I couldn't do basic math at that level that I was quote supposed to have done that. So I was always running around outside playing with the trees, you know, seeing magic everywhere around me. And so I just knew that I wanted to do something in nature for sure. And then as I progressed into that, what that turned into what I thought that was being a biologist, being an ecologist, studying the world around me is what I thought that looked like. And my dad, I had a lot of pressure from my dad to be a scientist. And so I was able to fuse those two. Okay, I'll be an ecologist and be in nature. And that's a scientist and it's all good. So that's what I thought. You know, certainly when I was in high school and college, that's what I thought I was going to do.
And did you ever go out into the world and utilize that degree?
I did that for a while. So I traveled around the world after my undergraduate degree in ecology. I traveled around the world. I call it my biobum phase, where I was an intern and got paid just enough money to fly somewhere and have room and board and live, you know. So I lived a couple years in the Congo Basin of Cameroon. I lived on the island of Hawaii for a while, studying the endangered birds there and on Maui. I was flown around, you know, I lived here in California and I was the ornithologist in Yosemite National Park for a season, you know, all over the world doing different things with birds and animals and monkeys. And I got a master's in that. I applied to a PhD program, which for birds, so I was an ecologist, but I mostly studied birds. And so the place to get a PhD in that was Cornell. It's the place. And I got in. And then I turned it down and I realized I didn't want to continue to be an academic and go on that route. Basically, I realized like academic science is really narrow. People who are successful, my mentors who were very, very good at what they did, the best in the world, they were very, very narrow in the way they thought about things and the way they approached their craft. To be a really good scientist, you have to go really, really deep into something. And my brain was much too broad and it was not a good fit for me. So I changed directions.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to ask you something that just kind of occurred to me, because obviously I read your profile on PodMatch. And one of the things that I thought was most provocative and interesting was that, you know, you spent this 2 years in Cameroon and with this group of people, and you say the most gorgeous thing. You say that group of people didn't view themselves as separate from the forest.
Right.
Now I'm butchering it. You said it way more gorgeously on your profile, but I do think it's interesting now reflecting back upon your childhood before fourth grade, where you were kind of just allowed to go to this unschooling or what have you, and just be where you were in that place as a child, doing what you would, free range kid, maybe, but not viewing yourself as separate from the learning process or what was even going to happen during the day. So I see some really beautiful parallels between that period of your life and these 2 years spent in Cameroon. Am I reaching?
I mean, so reflecting back, no, not at all. You're absolutely seeing the through line and the magic of what was happening with me. I'll say, though, that, you know, when I went to fourth grade, and then it was a really, really hard transition. I wasn't prepared at all. My parents didn't. They just threw me into this school and it was like I was an alien. You know, I literally had no concept of any of the rules or regulations. Regulations are like the social norms, the way to behave as a kid. Like, and so I was, you know, kids at that age are pretty mean. There's a big hierarchy and I was just brutalized. You know, again, I was raised in this way of like really deep sort of post hippie cooperative, you know, like universal love and acceptance. And so even like as boys, you know, when I was growing up, we would fight in my little hippie school, but like fighting was like wrestling, you know, and it wasn't trying to hurt somebody. So like the second day of school, this kid was like, oh, I want to fight you. And I was like, okay, you know, and then he just like, it punches me in the face and I go down and get a huge black, right? It's just, I was like, oh, the rules are different here. And that was sort of the metaphor for like the way it was for all of the areas of my life where I felt like I got punched in the face and didn't know what was coming. So by the time I got to grad school, I had spent years, my response to that, I guess, was that I spent years learning to fit in and learning to conform. You know, I say that, but I also realized really deeply that all of that was an act. So there's a part of me that, you know, I've been able to reinvent myself so many times over my career, over my life, because I knew that I could just be, I wasn't the thing. I could be whatever the thing was, and I could just move into that. So my time in the jungle with the Baka, the hunter-gatherer people I lived with, it was a shock for me to come back to that. And at first, you know, when they were you know, I was with them every day, and I was doing my studies, and they would be out there, you know, gathering mushrooms and hunting honey out of the trees and leaves and fruits and all the things. And then they would, you know, we'd sit down and eat lunch. We're out on the trail somewhere. And I'd say, like, oh, don't you need to bring some of whatever, you know, that back to the rest of the folks back at camp? They look at me crazy and be like, why? Like, what are you talking about? And I initially took that as like a selfishness. And it took me a while to realize, wait, everyone else is out also, wherever they are on the trails, doing their thing, getting what they need and being nourished in that moment exactly from the forest as equally as we are. It might be different, but everyone else is equally being nourished right now. There's nothing to save. There's nothing to like to hold on to, because everything simply is. Everything's provided. And that was, it took me a long time to make that transition in my thinking of them. Again, at first I judged them. I didn't understand what that was, you know, and then looking back, like they would say, they were very, very musical people. And so we would play music and sing all the time. And they would say, like, we're playing with the trees, was how they would phrase it. We're playing with the stream. And they're also, you know, they're a group of people that has a really iconic, like, water drumming, where they drum, they wade in the streams and rivers and like drum in the water and have these whole rhythms and then sing and chant. And it's amazing. And, you know, and literally they are singing with the rhythms of nature, because they are the rhythm of nature in the deepest way possible. I mean, it's the, you know, after that time, I studied many years, different non-dual traditions of spirituality thereafter. And it wasn't until years later that I, after studying these other non-dual traditions of spirituality, that I realized, as I do now, looking back, oh, in the deepest way possible, these were some of my deepest first teachers of non-duality, just not by any words they said, but simply by the way they lived. They simply were part of everything, full stop.
I was going to ask, I don't know if you read this on my bio, but I grew up overseas, and really my formative years were in Pakistan. And so I've talked about coming back to the States and being totally confused and upset about how all the rules had changed and the culture was completely different. And so having this 2-year experience in Cameroon, what was it like to leave and come back to, quote unquote, the real world?
It was a shock. It was rough. And to be clear too, I was there two different periods where I came back for a few months in between. But regardless, it was a really deep shock. And I had, you know, at the time I was thinking I was going to uncover all the secrets of the jungle, and it, you know, and I was looking at the deep forest structure and how the birds and monkeys and gorillas and chimps would spread the seeds, and then the forest would grow back. And that was the research I was doing. So I just threw myself into my data and like spent a couple years like entering data and looking at spreadsheets and trying to analyze things and write papers and giving talks and kind of close myself off from sort of other parts of the world. And that was when, you know, again, I did apply to my PhD program and got accepted. And then I just realized again, like, okay, actually this was all sort of took me down this really deep rabbit hole that wasn't really truly who I was. And I had no backup plan. I just turned down Cornell and had no backup plan. It was like, really like, oh, okay, what now? You know?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, going that far in your degree and in your learning, and then, but still having a sense after you apply for your PhD program, oh, I might be something else, or I might want to study something else, or another part of something is calling me. Was that terrifying?
I was young enough to be a little naive. You know, I was young enough to be a little naive, but there was a point after I turned it down when I didn't have a backup plan. And so I had to work my way through undergrad. So I worked as a cook and then became a chef through my undergrad. And so when I had no backup plan, I was sort of like, oh, well, I guess I can cook. I'll do that. So I got a few jobs as a cook, and then pretty quickly was able to get a job as a chef at a restaurant in the Bay Area, and then did that for about a decade, you know, and sort of switched gears in that way.
That is quite the switching of gears, I have to say. Now, bear with me. I'm a foodie. Okay. So I'm going to ask you what your favorite dish was to prepare.
You know, my favorite thing to prepare in a variety of dishes were wild mushrooms, wild harvested mushrooms. So, you know, this was California farm to table bear area. So I was getting, and I really spent a lot of time as a chef making sure, you know, the ingredients make the meal. And so I was working with, you know, all the beautiful local farmers and also local foragers. I would get wild nettles, wild black trumpets, and those would often come together in the same season and overlap, you know, wild chanterelles and lobster mushrooms and different things. And so it'd be, you know, constant riffs on switching up what I can do with the abundance that would come in that day and just making up different dishes on the fly week after week. So that part of the job was, you know, incredibly gratifying and really using the fruits of the earth in all the ways. And, you know, I became good friends with a bunch of the farmers, and they would just bring me their fresh produce every week and say, what do you want from this? And I'd go to the farmer's markets. And, you know, I wrote a farm to table cookbook too about chefs and restaurants working together with some recipes, and did profiles of a bunch of farms and restaurants working together. And, you know, during this time too, I it was too small for me. I love being a chef, but also my brain was a little bit needed more activity. So I became a writer, and I wrote a bunch of, at the time I was a newspaper columnist. So I was the first newspaper columnist writing articles about the ecology of food. Before it became a big thing. And I wrote a bunch of blog articles, and I started a pretty big food blog, which is still existing, and different things like that. So I got involved in other areas to sort of keep different parts of my brain working, and bringing the ecology of food and conservation, sustainability all into the forefront. I did that for a while.
Well, I think at this point we've established that you're lazy.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Don't really get anything done.
Right.
That's astonishing. I mean, just all the different capacities you have, because some could argue that getting a degree, your first degree in biology or your degree in biology, is very one side of your brain. And then being a chef is a completely different part of your brain. And there's this huge argument, or not, maybe not huge now, but a discussion, you know, people are either right brained or left brain, and never the twain, and, you know, they will not meet. But it seems like you have absolutely, that doesn't even matter to you.
Well, and so I've always, you know, I'm what they call cross dominant, or what they, I don't know what they call it now, what I was told growing up. So I'm, you know, left-handed, but I can do things with either hand. So like writing, I do left-handed, but middle scale things I can do with either hand. So when I would learn racket sports, tennis and racquetball, I would just switch hands and didn't have a backhand until the coach had told me I couldn't, you know, right? And I would never know which way, you know, skateboarding, I skateboarded as a kid, and I would just never know which was my dominant way. I would just alternate. And my friends were like, are you, you know, which way do you, and I would never know. I was just like, well, they're both perfect. And so I know that, and I'm dyslexic as well. So things are, that's also a, you know, the wires are crossed a little bit in my brain in certain ways, which now I deeply appreciate, but definitely caused some challenges that I learned to overcome and compensate for when I was, you know, more academic and in school and things like that. So certain things, in my brain, you know, now I know that I'm neurodivergent in all kinds of ways, which growing up, all of this was undiagnosed, you know, no, it wasn't a thing when I was growing up to have these. So I knew that I have these different parts of my brain that needed to come together in some way. And it's always been a journey for me to figure out and try to express how I saw the world, through, you know, my minor in college and undergrad was also poetry. So I would write, you know, I was a biologist, but I had a minor in poetry, and I was, you know, writing poems and performing and things like this, just as a way to keep myself whole.
I think you might be called a polymath potentially.
You know, if that's the label, I'll receive it.
Putting it out there. Well, you know, the second question of my podcast is, did you grow up in a religious household? And I'm so curious what that looked like as a child and how that evolved for you over time, if it did in fact evolve. Yeah.
So this is a fascinating one, because both of my parents met and bonded over their sort of, over my parents, turning away from their parents. So like, you know, my parents both sort of bonded over their rejection of how they were raised. And so my dad in particular, my grandfather was a minister, and his father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather, great uncle, I know, were ministers or Christian Presbyterian ministers. So generations, and my dad was a psychiatrist, became a doctor, turned his back on religion. Later in life, you know, he really firmly more accepted, he passed away, accepted God and religion. But growing up, it was very, on my dad's side, it was very sort of a-religious and sort of, it wasn't anti-religious, it was just like no religion at all. And then on my mom's side, she as well really sort of rejected. She was raised on the East Coast, very sort of proper New England upbringing. And she also rejected that. And, you know, I was raised sort of very hippie, as I mentioned, very sort of countercultural. So there was a deep sort of spirituality, but no religion at all, nothing organized at all, nothing at all. So I grew up with sort of this vague confusion around anything spiritual. And I had to find all of that out for myself, which happened really in college.
And I mean, if you feel like discussing it, I'd love to just have you explain how you maybe journeyed to the work that you're doing now.
Yeah, and it happens. Like people are like, how did you choose to do what you do now? And I was like, I didn't choose this in any possible way. It kept choosing me, and I kept saying no thanks. And then it kept choosing me more strongly until I had no choice but to do what I do now, which for those of you who don't know, you know, now I'm a spiritual mentor guiding people into non-duality and supporting them in non-duality, as well as I'm an Akashic reader, as well as a medium. So I'll channel people's ancestors and spirit guides for them. And I teach courses on how to do that as well and things like that. So that's the work I do now. And it took many years of spirit sort of showing up in my life and guiding me in ways that I couldn't ignore. And that's a long, long journey. And then I did make some choices, you know, after I turned down grad school, I actually met a man who became my guru. He was a tantric guru, classical tantra. And we learned, you know, I learned all the mantras and the yogas and all of the forms of classical Hindu worship and deep technology. And that was a beautiful path until it ended in sort of chaos when there was all kinds of accusations of abuse from the other students in my group, you know, and then he fled to Thailand. So there wouldn't be any repercussions of that, you know. And then I had another teacher that I ended up being with, who was a Taoist teacher who I studied with for many years. And his teachings really influenced me. But, you know, I was with those teachers because the spiritual impulse kept arriving for me. The spiritual impulse kept coming into my life in ways that I couldn't ignore, and things would show up and images would show up. And then on the other end of it, simultaneously, like when I was in the jungle, I had this experience where all of a sudden I was thinking of my grandfather again, who was the minister. And for about a week, I was thinking of him nonstop. And I was in the middle of the jungle. This was a time when there was, you know, no cell phones, no satellite phones, no communication with the outside world. I had no idea what was happening. And I remember even telling my friends and other scientists there, like, oh, when I go home, I want to see my grandfather. I miss him. I'm thinking about him this week. About 6 or 9 months later, I went back home and my dad casually mentioned, like, oh, at grandpa's funeral. And I was like, wait a minute, what? Grandpa died? I didn't know. I didn't know. And I asked him, you know, exactly when it was. And it was exactly that week when I was thinking of him. And so that was a really powerful shift in my consciousness, because the way I was, quote, thinking of him was so powerful to me that I had to communicate with my colleagues and friends. And when I realized he had passed away, I instantly knew that his spirit was coming to me and speaking to me and reaching out for connection. I instantly knew that that's what that was. I didn't have any context for that before that time, but I instantly knew that's what was happening. And then thereafter, other spirits, other ancestors started to come and speak to me and through me. And that sort of, I worked with that individually for many, many, many years before other spirits, guides, and ancestors would come to me to ask them to speak to other people on their behalf for them. You know, please give this person a message kind of thing.
Do you find it interesting? Because I find it fascinating that, you know, you have these grandparents, this uncle, who are called to be ministers, to be pastors, to be connected to God, to work for God, you know, and then your father turns away from that and says no. But it's almost like, you know, now the spirits, God is, it's all coming to you. And it's like, hey, this is 100%. Part of your DNA, maybe your ancestry, your lineage.
100 million percent. And you know, now also a lot of the work I do in supporting people is ancestral healing, is a lot of the work I do. And really one of, you know, it's not, I say like one of my gifts, and it's not a gift that I have. It's a gift of energy that comes through me. All I do is just get out of the way. I want to be really clear. Like, I don't do anything but get out of the way. And then certain energies and things come through. But one of the things that occurs is, in sessions with me, is there's a portal of nowness that opens up. So the ancestors can be right here, right now. All time is now anyway. I can see these currents of time and how our ancestral patterns influence people, everyone. It's very strong and obvious for everyone's lifetime. And so sometimes that can be really positive, quote, and sometimes it can be in directions that don't serve us now. You know, so if our ancestors had some sort of traumas, they want to keep us safe from those things. And we'll try to guide us away from them, even if those threats aren't current now. So that's just background. So with my ancestors, I absolutely know that I'm in this stream of this ancestral line doing this work. And even my ancestors, you know, my grandfather, who was, you know, Christian, and my great-grandfather, great-uncle, you know, they were Christian in a way because that's what there was during their lifetime. And there's, without any judgment for Christians or any value, it's just like that was the only acceptable way in their culture to be spiritual. That was the only acceptable way to bring through. And I remember, like, my grandfather, one of the last conversations I had with him was he looked at me and grabbed my shoulders. We were sort of alone, and he grabbed my shoulders and looked me in the eyes really seriously, which he never did this. And he said, this is the way he talked. He's like, "Boy, God is love. Do you understand?" And he was shaking me. He's like, "God is love." And he was looking me straight in the eye and, like, trying to transmit this truth. He was like, "God is love. God is love. Do you understand, boy?" And at the time, I did not understand. At the time, I did not understand. And now I know that that is... Now, independently, I know that my experience of the deepest connection with truth, the deepest way that us human bodies can experience the universal connection to all things, is through this emotion of love, through this feeling of love, not a romantic love, but this universal love of connection. That's like the closest we can get to the highest vibration on earth, is this thing we call love. I know that to be true. And that was his way of showing me, I think, really deeply that his values were really deeply beneath the doctrine, you know. And he knew that on the universal level, that we were all here in this soup of love, even if his own life was difficult, you know, and if his own life didn't always express that.
You have to know, even though I have a master's of divinity, I have read science magazines since I was a kid. So I'm a science aficionado. And so you just said, you know, something really interesting that I thought, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I've got Aaron here. I have to ask this question. And maybe it's nonsensical, but you said all time is now. But then I've also heard, you know, in some traditions that time is a circle. So how can you articulate that for me so that it's understandable? Yes.
I love that. And so my take on that is that, you know, time actually is not a circle as much as a spiral, perhaps, because so there is movement, but we do go through repeating cycles of time, but that they're not the same cycle, but they're repeating in the energies and the impacts and the effects of. So, for example, right now we're on a cycle of ascension. Right now, we're at this inflection point right now, and we're at the very, very beginning, and we're all feeling it. Those of us who are awake are feeling this in a massive way, of this massive global awakening, right? We're at this massive turning point. And we all know, you know, listening to this, you know, many traditions are saying that we're in this new era. You know, many traditions across all time are saying that we're entering a new era, and we're leaving an old era behind. Well, these cycles are vast in space and time. So there was another time when the Earth realm felt the same energy of ascension, but this was far beyond our Western view of history. This is far beyond, you know, Western history doesn't go that far back. It loses itself in some of the darker eras and disappears our history. And we say that was the end of humanity or the beginning of humanity. Well, no, it went back very much farther. So I see things as a cycle. But to back up with time, right, this is what I'm shown from my spirit guides really clearly about why do we have time in the way that we do here on Earth. And it's this. Our souls choose to come to Earth to experience the disconnection, because there's almost nowhere else I've been shown that has this much disconnection of our souls from the unity of Source. And so the purpose from this perspective, there can be many purposes of life, but from this perspective, the purpose of life is to enter a human body and be completely cut off, as we are, from the vastness of our soul's connection with all things, and then find our way back. And that includes through all of our traumas, all of our hardships, all of the quote bad things that happen, you know, on the individual level, with all respect and compassion for all of our suffering. I know for my own journey, I've had all kinds of trials and tribulations, and I'm thankful for all of them because they helped me to wake up and see the truth. And so our soul's journey is one of coming back into the rapture of the beauty of all things. And we cannot have that experience if we don't have time the way we experience it. If we don't pretend time is linear in this body with these five, you know, with these five senses, if we don't on this realm pretend time is linear, we don't have the experience of being disconnected and then feeling the reconnection. So that's the construct, but it doesn't exist anywhere else like this. There certainly are other ways that time and continuity is experienced in other realms, but it's not like this at all. You know, the ancestors that are around us, you know, when we die, the way I'm shown is that we can stick around for a while if there's still connections or unsolved, unfinished business with things here on Earth, with our family or with ourselves, we'll hang around. Otherwise, we can just go back into the ether and then cycle again in whatever ways we want to here on Earth or in other realms. But those ancestors who do hang around, they're not waiting in time for us. They're just here in the moment and experiencing all of their family linear connections right now. There, it could be, you know, great, great, great grandfather, and it's just a moment for them, you know, connecting with them. They're just alive, right here. So I don't know if that really fully answered that question.
Oh yeah. No. I, yes, absolutely. Believe me. I am like the annoying person that you never want to have like live next door to you, because I will have questions all the time at work. Beautiful. They make fun of me. I'm like the curious child that just will not shut up. I'm so curious. See, there it is. I'm so curious. Perfect. Now we were talking about love before, and your grandfather saying God is love, and looking into your eyes. My question is about love. Is love outside of time and space, because it is God and God is outside of time and space? Is it the warp and weft, the scaffold upon which everything is built? Love, we use this word, we're like love, but what does that really mean? I think it might be the architecture.
I love that. And I think, so I want to be, I'm going to say yes, but also give some context to what that, because, you know, many people who haven't thought about this question deeply might simply associate love with the deep connection with a lover, with a partner, and that kind of romantic love that, you know, falling in love with somebody and feeling that deep rapturous connection with somebody and like, oh, I love you and you love me and this is so beautiful and, you know. And the thing about that is that on a deeper level, what's happening is that that deep connection with another human is breaking down the boundaries of your sense of self and allowing you individually, aside from them, to feel the connection with the beauty of all things. And so, you know, when you're first, quote, falling in love with somebody, you know, the sunrise is brighter and your coffee tastes better and everything is sweet and lovely and you flow through life with this bliss. Again, we do that from this perspective because we've opened up our boundaries to connect with another human in this case. But really, the love is the opening connection to all things, which is why everything is sweeter, you know, when people are in love. And, you know, we can see people in love and we know how radiant and shiny they are. And then, you know, whatever happens with those relationships. So the love that is the fabric of the universe is not that love, because that's directed at another human. And it's not that per se, it's related. It's a cousin of that. Right. But it's the love of from our heart. So like in Taoism, we say the heart wisdom, you know, guides our life. It's not our brain. It's our heart wisdom. Right. So, and that would be another form of this. It's this universal connection and the love of like everything is the isness is another word that's used, right? We're pointed at something that cannot be talked about directly. This type of love is like we can point to it, but we can't really get to it because it is so universal that we can't see it or express it fully in these five sense realm. And so we have all the thousands of books of poetry about this because in all the paintings and we're pointing to something. So, but yeah, I absolutely do believe 100% what you said, that this true universal love is so, I don't think it's the fabric of the universe per se. It's as close as we can get as humans to express that. It's as close as we can get in this dimension to express what that fabric is. That's how I see it.
I am curious. I'm sure you know, as a former biologist, what a fractal is.
Yeah.
So I have always, you know, thinking in my downtime, which is often, the little gerbil inside my brain that's running around on the wheel, I've been contemplating fractals and how, you know, souls come back over and over in new iterations. And every time a fractal blooms or blossoms off the original, you know, fractal, I guess you could say, it is the same, but it's also something new because it is moved beyond itself. So I've started thinking about each lifetime of a soul is like our souls are fractals. So they remember the original, but they come into a new body in the next life and they are something new, but they are also the original.
So one of the terms that's used around fractals, one of the scientific words that they use to describe fractals is that the forms are self-similar across all scales. Is one of the ways they say that. So it's like, for example, for people who aren't familiar, when you look at the California coastline where I live in California, if you photograph a rock, a jagged rock on the edge of the ocean, and then photograph the whole 10-mile stretch, the structure of the edges of that rock and the edge of the coastline for 10 miles will have the same structure, but it won't be exactly the same form. Like the curves, the shapes aren't exactly the same, but overall that structure is the same, if that makes sense. And that's the same thing that I believe you're saying, right? So we're self-similar. We have the same form across soul lifetimes across lifetimes. But of course we have our individual imprint. And there's many ways we could describe this, but also we're coming in again. So time is a spiral in this realm. And so we come into a new set of conditions every time, you know, and we could say that's a new astrology every time. That's true. We come into a new family every time. That's true. We come into a new location potentially. That's true, right? So all the conditions around us are different. And also we have some agency individually as our souls with our soul's purpose. So we have some agencies and we learn lessons each time. And so the purpose of what we're coming into and for and why might be different as well. And so there's some lifetimes for sure where we might not have learned our lessons at all and the lesson might be the same. And maybe that's true for many lifetimes or maybe it's true for one or two. And then there are these times when we have these massive jumps of consciousness. And then the next lifetime, when we choose to come back to Earth, would look very, very different. You know, and I'll just say, you know, to double down on that and say that, again, we're right now in this time of a mass awakening. Yeah. So we have the opportunity. It's not guaranteed, but for those of us who are waking up and choosing to do the work with integrity and choosing to open up and listen to the universe's signals and choosing to take this seriously and grow how we can, this is the lifetime for many of us where we do have a chance to make these really radical jumps of consciousness, which then can change the course of our next journeys and beyond.
Thank you. I'm curious, have you ever heard of Maya Deren?
I don't.
She was a cultural anthropologist, documentary filmmaker that lived in the 40s and 50s, went to Haiti and studied voodoo for multiple years. And she wrote this incredible book called The Divine Horseman, which I read before I started seminary. And basically, I mean, she was there for years, and she talks about the elaborate ceremony that goes along with calling a god down. And basically a god comes and mounts a human being. The human being changes all of their speech patterns, the way they walk, the way they talk, everything, because something has inhabited. The god has come down and mounted them like a horse. And afterwards, they don't remember anything. But it sounds like for you, when you have these experiences, you remember. Is that true?
100%. So there's a lot of ways we can communicate with different beings, right? And so for me, when I'm communicating with them, I'm communicating. So for me, I see everything from this perspective as vibration. Everything is a vibrational frequency. And so for me, as I say, I'm literally getting out of the way. And I do, you know, I sort of tune my frequency band up and open to, you know, higher frequencies, whatever that means, so that I'm at the frequency potentially of these realms of connection. So I can tune my band up, you know, metaphorically to this band of an ancestor realm where I know that in this band of energy, this is where the ancestors hang out. And then I receive those level of messages. And then I can tune up just beyond that, which for me is how it works, where I've, you know, spirit guides and sort of angels and other beings hang out if they want to speak. That's a simple, simplified version. So I do that in the work I do. And I'm very conscious when I'm channeling for someone, if I'm working with you, you know, I'll even, what I say for people is like, I can, you know, receive information from your spirit guides or your angels or your ancestors or also the Akashic field. And I'll tell you where I'm speaking from. And then I'll tell people, like, if I'm interjecting like Aaron, then I'll sort of tap my chest as a way, that's my own personal physical shorthand to just clarify with you that, oh, this is me speaking like with, for me, my ego, this person here versus like whatever's coming through. So I'm very conscious the whole time. And I, you know, in my work with people, I say, you know, you can always interrupt me. You can redirect me. This is for you. You know, it's all here right now. Now that's one whole way to communicate. The way I would talk about this mounting process and, you know, these ceremonies that you mentioned would be a form of being taken over and being possessed by a spirit. And there's nothing good or bad around that inherently at all, right? Depends on, are you a willing participant? Are you aware of this? Is it a spirit or God that you want to bring down and possess you and bring forward these whatever words they want to share or energies or whatever it might be, right? And there's possession that, you know, many channels become possessed in certain forms and don't remember. They have to listen to their tapes or recordings to recall what was said. That's, you know, many of those experiences. I've also seen possession occur in like plant medicine ceremonies where people, you know, are in altered states of consciousness through these plant medicines, maybe mushrooms or ayahuasca or other things. And, you know, other energies can come into that space if the shaman holding the ceremony is not powerfully doing, quote, the right thing to keep those energies out. Dark energies, for example, I've seen this happen, can flood in. And I've seen rooms of people being taken over where their eyes shift, their behavior shifts, the way they dance and move and speak entirely changes. And they're being taken. And I see the energies come in. These dark demons, potentially, whatever word we want to use, come into the room and take over people. And then, you know, the music or that part of the ceremony might shift, and then those energies will disappear again, and the people won't remember that it happened. So I've seen this happen in real life. It's phenomenal. You know, these ceremonies of connection, you know, through voodoo, through the African traditions, through all the traditions of the world, you know, all true intact indigenous cultures throughout the world have ceremonies like this, where we can connect with spirits. And you know, and we connect with spirits, quote, both good and bad, whatever that might be, because all the energies are necessary, whether they're a dark spirit or a light spirit or gods or however we want to speak of these entities. We you know, the fact is we are interacting with them all the time, whether we are aware or not. So if we choose as a culture to be conscious of it around how we're going to interact with them, well, there's a power to that. And we can utilize that in whatever way that culture chooses to do so.
Yeah, I've thought to myself often, you need to be respectful and you need to have gratitude. So if you were to talk to my spirit guides, they would say this one is a whiner and very salty. So be careful. I know this about myself. I know it already. So it's okay. But yeah, I'm sure they're like this one over here is, geez, a lot of
work. They have so much love for us. They have so much love for us. You know, they see us and just sort of shake their head with like, because the thing is they can, you know, in general, even our ancestors, but especially our spirit guides and angels, they can see the difficulties and trials and tribulations that we experience on earth, but they're in this realm of deep connection with the unity of all things. And so they can't really fathom it. Like they see it, but also can't fully understand it, which is why I'm shown that there's a waiting list of souls coming that want to come to earth, which is also why right now, because of this mass awakening, there's so many people on earth right now, because there's so many souls wanting to have this experience. And so our angels and spirit guides are souls that are entities that are choosing to be our support team. They're choosing this and they love us so much. You know, they might see us as little sort of, not in this way, but like an ant farm kind of thing, not really that extreme, but you know, we can't really imagine what it's like to be an ant in the little ant farm, but we can have deep compassion for them. And in a certain loose way, that's kind of how it is with our spirit guides and angels. They don't really understand the limitations that we experience because it's such a wild amusement park ride kind of thing to be so cut off from truth. It's so wild.
Yes, it's wild and painful, I suspect, for some people. You know, people that, you know, kind of have a glimmering of a remembering of what connection looks like, I suspect it can be very painful. So, well, you know, I could talk to you for 10,000 years, just to be honest, which according to you, I mean, and I agree, we actually have 10,000 years. I would just have to find you in every lifetime and we could like have this conversation continue. But I have to ask the main question of the podcast, which is, you know, Aaron, I would love to hear any kind of one story, two stories, whatever you'd like to share about that you feel might was magical or miraculous, mysterious. You talked about what happened with your back last week, but anything you feel called to share, I would love to hear whatever it is.
You know, this world is so full of magic. This world is so full of magic. You know, and so I'm just going to quickly just like say a few things and not even necessarily stories, you know, like the fact that we can talk to trees and they can talk back to us, you know, like now this I take for granted and I talk to trees and they talk to me every day. When that first started to happen, it was a period of deep magic. You know, I talk to rocks and I talk to the water and the sky and they talk back, they communicate back to me, not with words, with mouths that appear and things like that, but simply with their energy and their vibration. They communicate back this deep, deep wisdom of healing and connection and knowledge and guidance. They guide us. So that's, you know, that's just one thing I wanted to share about magic. That's, you know, this is, we're in this time of awakening where those things are normalized. And so like one of the first things I always say with people I work with when they're asking me, how can they, you know, you're saying, you mentioned a person that might have an inkling or a little pull, but is not fully connected to this deeper pull of, you know, pool of spirit yet. And, you know, they're like, how do I feel this way, but I'm not sure. And there's a period of really deep discomfort, as you describe. One of my first recommendations is always like, spend more time in nature and really sit deeply and like really connect and talk to these powerful teachers that we have all around us, you know, really powerful teachers. Yeah, magic is so, so powerful. As I first started to wake up, you know, different magical things would appear. And then I was taught from my years of spiritual teachings to not attach meaning to the magic, to let it go. Because anything that appears magical in our experience is also an illusion. It's also part of the Maya of the thing. So if we attach meaning to any of it, then we can actually get stuck there by the shiny thing. But for example, during my awakening, one thing that started to happen was that words of truth would start to illuminate, is the word I use. You know, so as you know, being, you know, a doctor of divinity is this period of time in the medieval ages where the Christian books would be illuminated with gold and beautiful drawings. and they called it illumination, to bring, they were bringing life to the scripture through these beautiful ornate drawings. And so I was, you know, I was awakening through this process a number of years ago, and I was driving by on the freeway, and there'd be this billboard with some words of Jesus. One of the Christian groups would have a billboard of, you know, listen to Jesus. And all of a sudden, some of his words just like glittered in gold and then like danced off the page, off the billboard. Some of his, the words of Jesus just like glittered in gold and then like sort of shimmered off into the unit. I was like, wow, that's kind of weird. And then, but then what happened is I have, you know, I read texts from all traditions, just any of this, these books of growth, awakening, sacred poetry, sacred awakening. That's my jam. That's all I, you know, I have all around me. And so I would read books, and all of a sudden certain phrases within the books would start to illuminate in that way. That's my word for that, would start to shimmer with truth. And what I think now, and that happened for maybe 6 or 9 months, and then it went away. And I don't do that. That doesn't happen for me anymore, but it's fun to talk about, not because it's important, but because it's like the ways the mystery of truth can come through for us can be anything. The way that magic can appear for us can look like anything. And so it wouldn't be like all the words in whatever text, but it would be those that had like this highest true kernel vibration of perfection in a certain way would vibrate and shine, and just sort of like this magic would appear. And so it isn't like the rest of the words weren't truth, but they were, you know, there's often like background explanation or sort of words that paragraph that lead us towards this nut of truth, this kernel of truth. This deep phrase of like, okay, this is the deepest truth from this whole passage. And so I would eagerly go through all of my books for quite some time and like looking for what were these passages that were just really like vibrating at this level of magic. So that's a fun little thing that just occurred to me. But right now too, you know, so for, I just had this accident last week where I had a really bad fall off a ski hill and really deeply bruised my back in a way that I know was a miracle that I didn't die or become paralyzed. You know, I'm bruised from my middle back all the way down past my butt, and it's, you know, I it's not broken, but it's just like I could, last week I could barely walk, and now I'm walking. I'm very, very, very lucky, very blessed. In that, since that time, I've always felt and known the power of prayer, but right now, you know, my friends, and I've been asking my friends, and they've been voluntarily praying for me and sending me love and blessings and prayers, and I feel and see the prayers come through right now in ways that I didn't know was possible. This is a brand new thing that's just I'm experiencing right now where I'm like, oh, someone's praying for me right now, and I can feel the vibrations of their prayer, and I can feel it come into me and heal me. And I can feel the beauty and the truth of this practice. And I don't know if I can describe it deeper than that. I literally feel the vibrations coming into me in a way. And I see, for example, to give more context to this, like I see our timelines of our life as like these streams of energy that can fan out into possibilities. And we have all the inputs behind us is the way I see it, of like our past, of all the energies that directed our lives to what they are to this moment. So like I see things as like bands of shimmering energy in various ways as I enter the energy field. So it's almost like that, but it's more subtle. It's a new thing for me that I'm just integrating, where like I feel these pulses of prayer come from people, and I can even usually know who they're from and just feel the healing vibration of them. And it's this beautiful gift of knowing, like I've always known that these practices were powerful and real. And now to feel it and know it on a much deeper level in my whole being is feels like really deep, powerful magic. Just, and so when I wanted to share that, like, you know, these practices of devotion, these practices of prayer, these practices of connection with spirit from all traditions, you know, as we delve into them, like they're deeply real. There's nothing made up. Yeah, parts of it are made up, and parts of it maybe are, of course, but the core beliefs that have lasted through, you know, countless generations from these traditions, there's the deep truth of all of them is so powerful and real. And even if we can't experience it ourselves in our spiritual evolution right now, the belief and the gratitude for these practices and the belief in them is the healing that people need, is the healing that is required to keep us in alignment with the frequencies, which then will carry us further. Like, there's this point on the path where, you know, you asked me earlier on in the conversation, how did I end up doing the work I do now? And it's kind of like, one way to say this is that I got pulled in by these small streams, and all of a sudden I got thrown into the middle of the river, where then there became no choice. And now I'm in the river. And with this mass awakening right now, I see more and more people all of a sudden being pulled into the river. And the river is this energy of spiritual current where all of a sudden, like without even knowing why, with our brains, we're pulled in a direction where our heart is telling us, this is who you are now. And it's inescapable. And that's also a deep magic to see and understand that flow of the energy, this awakening that's happening.
Absolutely. I was going to say, I really appreciate, I mean, just your story about the prayers and these blessings that people are sending your way. And your ability to feel the intention or the vibration and to receive it, right, to take it in, is really powerful. It's really powerful. And I think there's all these stories, right, about miraculous healings and, oh, this person healed. And how did that even happen when they only had like 2 months to live? And but they had a big prayer group at their church that, you know, dedicated an hour one day, and hundreds of people came in and prayed for the person, and then they got better. And I think your story certainly goes to bolster those stories about what's actually happening, that it's, you know, very natural. It's love, number one, but then it's also physics.
It's energy and vibration. Yeah. This is real, you know, and this is what's so funny is that, you know, we know that our five senses don't measure all the energy that science can measure. Yes. You know, on the light spectrum, we know that, you know, light, our eyes can only measure a certain, can only see a certain frequencies, and that we know that those same energies continue on both directions, higher and lower. Yeah. And same thing with sound, you know, and they're all actually, that's all the same thing, but the frequencies go off in directions that are higher and lower, more fine and more dense, far beyond what our eyes and ears and other sensors of our body can experience. Yeah. We know this. This is science. This is not. And so, but then science says, oh, but if we can't measure it, it might not be real. You know. And so science is catching up to us, right? Science is catching up. But these energies are, the energies of prayer, the energies of spirituality broadly are on the much more fine end of the spectrum, whatever that means. But they're real. And we are, you know, here's the thing, like our bodies are alchemical receptors made specifically to receive this energy. This is not like literally our bodies, our nervous systems, our energies, the way we're structured is made so that we can receive and also send these frequencies, these energies, these prayers, these all of our thoughts. You know, the truth is we're praying, quote, all the time. All of our thoughts are creating vibrational frequencies around us. That the world then responds to.
Right.
This is, and this is, you know, science also knows this, but just on a more limited scale, that we are affecting the world around us through the energies of our thoughts and our mind and our being and our frequencies. And, you know, the world's catching up in terms of science to the fact that this is all true. And as you said, there are so many examples right now of people who are faking it. So, you know, using discrimination. I had a friend who went to Bali and there was this man doing these miracle healings with electricity, but it came from his body and it was really magical. And then all of a sudden it turned out he was hooked up to a battery the whole time. And my friend was duped, you know, and there's a whole like movie about that, but you know, he was hiding the battery and like doing these things and was duping people, you know? So that's one example of many of people who are simply trying to make a buck or make a quick name for themselves or whatever. So as you go through the path, you know, I've had some, as I mentioned earlier, I've had some teachers that I look back on and were some questionable choices, even though I learned a lot from those experiences. You know, as you go forward, like definitely use your discrimination. It's okay to make mistakes and then choose as you grow from wherever you are now.
I did appreciate what you said before, that you are a vessel or a channel for that energy, for that advice, whatever wants to come through. The people you should be you know, wary of and maybe steer clear of are those that, you know, claim to be gurus, who claim to have the answers, who claim to know it all, and never once, you know, kind of allude to the fact that it's not them doing it. They all say that they're doing it. So yeah, be careful of those people. So when you said that you were a channel, I was like, yes, yes.
Thank you for that. You know, and that's why even for years, because of, again, I had this, you know, bad experience with my former teacher guru, for years I resisted mentoring and supporting people. And then finally it was like, okay, that's just out of fear in my own self, and I need to move into this. But it is why I refer to myself as like a mentor, a spiritual mentor, which I'm just here to, the way I like to say it is like, I'm just someone, I'm not special. I'm just someone who has walked the path. You know, if I'm climbing a mountain, I got up earlier maybe and like walked a little farther, and then there's a landslide and I can walk back and say, hey, here's a way around that landslide. I can show you what I did. And then you can make your own decisions and follow some techniques if you want to, and then travel the path on your own. It's like that. It's as simple as that. I just maybe got up earlier than you, or I'm older than you, or I had some more experiences than you. You know, it's not that it doesn't mean anything about me at all. It's just like I walked this path a little further and now I can share some things. It doesn't need to be special. Right. It's just, it's more powerful when it's more ordinary, right? When we're to say that all of us have this ability, quote, all of us have this power. All of us are this inherently. In fact, there's nothing to do but get out of the way. We already all have this. All of us, every single one of us can talk to our spirit guides and angels, can connect with all the energies of the universe, can move the pyramids if we really get there, all of us. And we just have to, you know, it can take some time to deconstruct the ego that's been constructed by our society and culture, because we lived in a culture in America where we've been taught for the last couple thousand years, perhaps, to cut ourselves off from direct connection with spirit. And we have to relearn these ways.
That's a wrap on this episode of the podcast and my conversation with Aaron French. Now, Aaron is many things, as I'm sure you understand now. But again, like, let's reiterate, he's a mentor, an Akashic reader, and spiritual practitioner for over 30 years. And he's also a psychic medium. And let's be honest, sometimes it's good to consult a psychic if you're so inclined, because maybe you just need a few clues as to the direction your life is going or which path you should take. So there will be a link in the episode show notes to contact Aaron and schedule your very own session. Once again, I have brought you another excellent human being who's doing good work in this world and making it a shinier and brighter place. Please do remember that ratings and reviews are ever so groovy. So if you like what you hear, please consider giving me a rating or writing a little review. Those ratings and reviews help other people find us. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Aaron. I mean, honestly, talk about flexibility. He uses both sides of his brain and then everything in between. You know, he might have started life off as a scientist, but look where he is now. He's been open to the mystery. He's been open to the mayhem. Because honestly, when your life starts going in a direction that you haven't planned for, there can be some mayhem. But Aaron is open to it because it's an adventure. Or at least I suspect it's an adventure. So be like Aaron, be open and flexible to the mystery and the mayhem that's unfolding all around you. See you next week, and I hope this next little bit of time is filled with laughter, with joy, and with strangers who ultimately become your friends. Thank you.